Hello, I'm Christopher Simpkins, a student at Lodge Park Academy, Northamptonshire. I'm here with the Naked Scientists on a one-week placement, thanks to the David Ross Education Trust, to find out more about depression. It's thought that around 1 in 6 people will be affected by depression at some point in their lifetime. The symptoms of the illness are depressed mood, poor concentration, decreased energy, low self-worth, disturbed sleep, and change in appetite, prolonged over a period of 2 weeks or more. Worryingly, figures suggest 1 in 10 young people below the age of 18 have some form of depression, yet many people still choose to ignore the topic. Little is known about which areas of the brain cause depression and which are affected by the illness. There is also uncertainty on the illness's brain-altering effects in the long term and whether depression can cause lasting damage to the brain. So, I met Professor Ian Goodyear. He researches depression, how the brain changes during teenage years, and how genetics and the environment affect the illness. I started by asking him why we know so little about what causes teenage depression and how it affects the brain.
The reasons why it's difficult to know what the causes of depression are at the brain level is because the brain's growing and changing, and we don't yet understand what the implications of brain growth and change are for mental illness. But it looks like, in a nutshell, that there's a disconnection between earlier parts of brain growth and the bits that come a bit later, in later adolescence and early life. So one causal process might be a disconnection between parts known as the limbic system and parts known as the prefrontal cortex or the frontal cortex, so that individuals might not show very good connections between those two areas. But as we understand a bit more, we're beginning to see that, curiously enough, some individuals might be depressed because they're overconnected. So, like a lot of systems in the body, there might be an optimal range at which the brain works efficiently and effectively. The second bit is that when people are depressed, we do know there's a lot of brain problems going on. One of those problems is the failure of the front of the brain to suppress the action in the middle of the brain. So this is a problem of frontal suppression, and that makes an area of the brain called the cingulate gyrus a bit problematic, because it's like a roundabout on a motorway. Lots of activity goes through the anterior cingulate, both from the bottom of the brain and coming down from the top. So the roundabout gets a bit kind of screwed up. And the final bit is, are there people who have consequences? Are there residual brain difficulties? Again, the answer looks like yes. And so far, those seem to be mostly in areas to do with the middle of the brain, funnily enough. So things like the hippocampus in the middle, which is very important for memory and for processing emotions, and its related structures might well be rather sensitive if depression, particularly if it goes on for a long time, so that some individuals might end up with some deficits that they then have to handle in different ways to the population that's never been depressed. So there's no question that for some people, depression is a brain illness. But for others, depression might have minor effects on the brain. Just like if you cut your hand, you don't always need to have stitches. So for a lot of people, their brains appear to be quite resilient. And that's why, perhaps, that's why they recover more.
You said about it's about different connections, but are there different chemicals that can be related, even though we don't know whether or not they are caused or affected by depression?
There's been some very important theories and consequential research on three different levels of chemistry in the brain. The one that's been the most interesting in behavioral science have been the monoamines, because they're the end stage molecules in a cascading process in brain cells. And the serotonin depletion hypothesis, which is now 50 years old this year, has been a very dominant force. More recently, dopaminergic hypotheses have been important because people interested in function, particularly in loss of functions, like loss of motivation and poor decision making, have shown that dopamine is a signal in those neural systems of some importance. But we also know that dopamine and serotonin are forever entangled with each other. And I think that we probably all agree that the monoamine models are more complicated than single studies on one or the other can show.
What about nature versus nurture? Is there any way of knowing if how someone is brought up affects how they feel or if they get depressed?
So actually, we have much better information about the environment's risk than we do about genetic risk. So genetic risk is mostly inferential at the moment through studies that don't actually measure the genes that might be depressogenic, because we don't know what those are. But we do know that adverse childhood and family environments are highly likely to be associated with an increased risk for depression. So, if anything, our understanding is based much more on experience-dependent effects than it is on genetic-dependent effects. I no doubt will find genes eventually, but I'm not sure that they will be ever as important as the consequences of genes. So the catchphrase is genes propose, environments dispose, and we know more about dispositions than we do about proposals.
Thank you. At the beginning of this interview, I quoted the figure that 1 in 6 people may be affected by depression in their lives. Do you think this is a high figure? And has it increased since you started your research?
Well, I don't think the figure's increased because we've been better at detection than, say, watching a secular rise in depression. But there has been a secular rise in depression between 1945 and the year 2000. There's quite good secular evidence for that, as there has been in a number of mental health disorders. Not severe depression, not psychoses, not a number of others, but the mild to moderate disorders have probably increased since the Second World War. I don't think that the overall incident risk rate is probably that different. And think of it like a whole range of illnesses. It's a family of disorders and difficulties and illnesses. And probably the vast majority, certainly 2/3 or so, will be mild. They'll be transient. They'll be very distressing and unpleasant, but they will recover. And many of them will recover spontaneously. They don't need to come and see healthcare professionals. People will be depressed for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks, but they will recover. And that's because they're own self-righting and recovery mechanisms will do the job. There's no reason for those individuals not to have just general good support from their friends and family and sympathy, and they probably get that as well. It's a bit like saying, does everybody who cuts their finger need to see a plastic surgeon? Well, no, but it's a good idea to know how to make sure it doesn't get infected and put a plaster on it if needs be and look after yourself. And I think for the vast majority of mild to moderate depressions, that might be enough. The other third, they're probably quite unwell and may well need to get inside the health system for further help and intervention.
What sort of treatments would these more at-risk people receive?
Well, there's a difference between what they should get and what they receive. Anyone who's depressed should receive psychosocial support systems in primary care. That should be the point of call. A proportion, and it's not known how many, I'm going to suggest that between the ages of 11 and 20, it's about 20 to 30%, should rapidly move to antidepressants plus specific psychological treatment if they're not responding to simple support.
What would you say is your biggest breakthrough, or has been the biggest breakthrough, in the time that you've been researching this topic?
I think that we have made terrific advances in treatment. If you look worldwide at what was happening 100 years ago, then the average depressed young person would spend years in hospital. Some would never leave. And that is just unthinkable now, totally unthinkable. What is a worry at the clinical level is the rising suicide rates amongst young people between 15 and 25, and particularly men. And one of the interesting things about the disorder is that we don't know how yet to distinguish those who will need more things as time goes by from those who need perhaps not too much.
Thank you, Professor Ian Gidger, and thank you for listening. I hope you found this as informative and interesting as I have. If you feel you're affected by depression or want more information, you can search depression on the NHS website, nhs.uk, or go to time-to-change.org.uk. The song I used in this podcast was Medusa by Barney Brown from the Intercontinental Music Club.